So actually, that kind of is relevant to our talk tonight, actually. We're now on the fourth talk. Now, even though this says complete teachings of Mahayana, I want to stress this is not by any means a complete teachings of Mahayana. It's actually been retitled Glimpses of Mahayana, and in case you wanted to buy a copy of this now, there is a new book that's out, and I may have mentioned this previously. It's called Glimpses. Glimpses of Profound. And it combines four texts, which are all called glimpses. So glimpses, this was retitled Glimpses of Mahayana. We have Glimpses of Space, which is a very extraordinary presentation of the feminine principle and how it works in terms of inside, outside, and beyond the mind. We have Glimpses of Realization, which is only for, at this point, possibly very, very open sense of contemplation. You could read a page and don't worry about trying to make sense out of it. Just you've read the words and you can sort of rest on that. I mean, it's a very profound, it's extremely profound. Fourth glimpse is, it's not, Glimpses of Abhidharma, which we studied.
That's it.
They don't combine that, no. It's just the three.
Well, it's not Abhidharma.
Yeah, the Glimpse of Abhidharma is still a separate text. anyway, it's well worth having as something to keep on your shelf. And you know, this is basically a introduction, but an overview and also a way to get into Mahayana as a way of understanding so that we're actually, it's a rather unusual way to introduce Mahayana, I can tell you that. Uh-huh. Normally, just to give you contrast, when you train in the Hinayana teachings or the Theravada teachings, where we're talking about taming your mind and taking responsibility for your experience and cutting attachment and basically reducing your involvements in the world, establishing simplicity and silence and peace. So now this is when you go into the traditional Mahayana, you get one of the most classical expositions is called Jewel Ornament of Liberation. And that actually takes you right into why Mahayana is what it is and how it's a step further in terms of understanding how to bring your experience onto the path and open up. And it introduces the entire system of Mahayana. Now, Mahayana is a huge, huge, vast body of teachings. So even that is not meant to cover all the bases. But it does give you the basic practice outline in terms of what one does when one really practices and how you begin to rewire yourself from simply cherishing yourself and thinking about you as being the most important person in the universe to shifting to understand, and this is a big leap, that other people are more important than you are. Okay? But you don't do that until you really, really feel that way. You don't force this on yourself. It's not like you're supposed to think this.
We're getting a lot of grimaces.
Well, so actually, I think this is a way to sort of provoke a little response. I'm really interested, because I've missed a couple of classes, how everybody's feeling about these teachings so far.
Sorry.
Would anybody like to say anything or have any questions, particularly in terms of the prior classes that have brought us to this point?
So the Earth doesn't revolve around us?
Sorry?
It revolves around me.
Now I understand.
Am I what I'm wearing?
The second book, after the glimpses, you said there's another book. It's called.
You mean introducing me to Mahayana?
Yes.
The big text is called Jewel Ornament of Liberation.
Okay, but it's a giant text.
Well, it's not giant, but you know, it's a few hundred pages. It's by Gampopa, and Gampopa I believe we brought his name up. That's when we recite.
We do the four dharmas.
The four dharmas of grand chair blessings at the beginning. That's of Gampopa. He is considered the author of that, those four lines. And he was basically the person who really organized the Kagyu school of Tibetan Buddhism into a very comprehensive path, whereas previously it was primarily for yogis. And it became much more structured and regimented, you could say, in terms of to accommodate a monastic discipline and basically even governance, because the monastery governed the areas where they were in Tibet. So basically it was much more complex. But he was the person who really could harness all that and bring it together for the very first time in a very new and fresh way. So, any questions at this point before we go forward on compassion? We've been looking at Buddha nature, which seems to be, at this point, the question of having to ask questions, of being dissatisfied. Things aren't working, and we want to know why. We want to look into what's going on. We actually are experiencing. We're not experiencing, it just is not working, right? I mean, that's the first basis of how Buddha nature is presented here. Things aren't working, we want to ask questions. As human beings, we have this special characteristic of being able to question what we're doing here. As far as I know, animals do not. I can't be 100% sure, but at least we know we can ask these questions. And if we don't ask these questions, then we are simply going to follow passion and fickleness, desire and frustration. Right? Or not? Okay.
Wait, Megan.
No, what? You caught me in a moment where I was not here.
Yeah. And then you came back and I was like, what?
That's okay.
Gone.
So one of the definitions that I recently studied or came across in another class I'm working on is just a simple way we describe what is dharma. How can we understand dharma in terms of how it relates to us? And the key point that Trungpa Rinpoche was stating is passionlessness. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean we don't have feelings or emotional experiences, but it means we are not interested in being caught up and just pursuing things for our own pleasure and well-being and comfort. That is the real meaning of passionlessness. And so when we talk about passion, aggression, and ignorance, we're not talking about turning into somebody walking around in an emotional straitjacket or, you know, completely refusing to acknowledge their feelings and their impulses. But fundamentally, we're not interested in just following those things willy-nilly. Right? We really want to be free from being driven by simply what comes into our head at any given moment.
So it's sort of like not like every commercial that comes through your head. Oh, I need that.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's okay. Passion. It's like,
right.
Well, that guy looks good, you know, whatever.
Right.
We're seeing and grabbing, wanting to grab it for yourself. Okay. And we're starting to notice that quite a bit at this point, I would imagine, how we habitually do that.
Yeah, I mean, this is the program we're into. Michael doesn't like me to mention this notion that we are in what's called the desire realm, but I mentioned it anyway.
Michael biting his tongue over there.
We won't go into detail about it right now. But fundamentally, it means that this is our chief thing that's staring us in the face all the time. It's grasping and fundamentally trying to go after what we want. And discovering once we get what we want, we don't even care anymore because we want something else.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, it just goes on and on and on. It's the snake biting its tail. So then we went into spiritual friend. And spiritual friend, was last week.
Mm-hmm.
And we're discussing I just don't. We began to introduce the notion of Maitri. We can't really have spiritual friend until we actually are willing to be friends with ourselves and establish a fundamental position of warmth towards our experience. Now, you know, guess what? We're doing this for the rest of our lives. It's not like, oh, I got that done. I've suddenly figured out how to be friends with myself, you know, like no problem. It keeps coming up. But it's a fundamental shift in our willingness to lean into our situation and be open to our experience as it arises. And it's only then that we can actually acknowledge the value of someone as a teacher without, or someone who could help us. And it's not just one person, it could be many people, but because spiritual friend is someone, many could be more than one person. We're not just talking about a singular person here. Because you're willing to actually acknowledge that, you know, there's something out here, we're learning how to learn from each other. And that's very important. And it comes from our trusting ourselves. That's critical.
I really appreciate the contemplation stuff that Emily posted. Mm. That has been really very powerful, very helpful practice. I sit and I cry for 10 minutes and then I stop. Ding! Stop. Go to the next one.
Yeah, I actually have to work with it more myself because, as I said before, that was never part of our training. But in this retreat, at this Catholic place, I picked up a sheet. It's actually on how to do contemplative meditation. And I actually brought it home. I thought it was pretty good. And it was exactly what I laid out. So it's definitely across different traditions. And it's really a way of... I wanted to answer something that Janet said the other night, and I was a little confused when I answered it, so just for one second I want to say this. When you do the contemplation, it's actually not really an analytical exercise, and you don't go back to figure out your family of origin or where these things came from that you don't like about yourself. It's more a sense of settling into the feeling of what it is where you are being self-critical or putting yourself down, and then allowing yourself to rest with the feeling of that. So it's really not a mental exercise as much as it's something deeper than that. And settling in to the feeling. So there are different layers there that you can go through without, it's not logically figuring things out. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Okay, I wanted to restate that since I didn't.
Do you try to release that in any way, or is it, you know, or recapture the energy, or
no,
like
it's
that?
Nothing, it's nothing programmed at all. It's just
sitting
feeling
it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And see what you see from it, you know. Then what is the progression of that as you go deeper into that feeling? So you start to see your patterns, which you see when you're meditating all the time, what comes up. And then if you really look at Maitri, how are we being critical to ourselves? What is it? What's my story I tell myself over and over? And if you release that, then... What would be the reverse of that if it's always critical? What would be a new story that actually would be maybe closer to the truth?
Mm-hmm. That's kind of what I started to see is, like, I thought about somebody else said to me, I have this issue and I'm really having a hard time. You know, I give them a hug and I say, I can see that's really, like, how hard that is for you. Mm-hmm. What a struggle you have with it. And so I sort of started trying to say that to myself. Like, oh, I see. You know, like, how hard that is for you. Which I never had done before. I was just like, you know, just
so one of the interesting things that we talked about from the very beginning with even our meditation instruction is not trying to change anything.
Right.
So when we talk about leaning in, We're leaning into the sharp points, not so we can massage them over and smooth them, but actually just open ourselves up. And as we go forward, you know, very naturally, our vipassana mind will start to just look. And as it looks, things change. They're not changing in terms of our doing anything to it as such, but the actual seeing it changes yes. the texture and the quality itself. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, something that seemed totally impossible to face, just utterly painful, as we simply lean into it, we didn't have to lean to it forever, obviously, we lean into it for a while. And this is one of the things that Rinpoche talks about, is these little shots, these little momentary shots, glimpses. We're not trying to hold on to anything.
Did you use the word shot?
Like a quick shot, you know,
shot.
A quick flash.
Okay.
A flash on opening up to it and then dropping it. So we're not just becoming masochists about leaning into our pain. But, you know, actually, we do, like, just give a moment of simply impersonal. It is impersonal. Where we're not, nobody's concerned about the outcome of this. We're just seeing it. That's the issue. Awareness does not have personality. There is no personality to awareness at all. It is completely clear, and it doesn't have any bias. Now, as we learn more about that, it helps us rely on that as a real friend, that we can actually trust that awareness itself can actually is going to provide a capacity to actually see things that are pretty uncomfortable and difficult. Mm-hmm. And, you know, in the process, it starts to free up. So, back to the text here. We're moving from Maitri to in oneself to Maitri expanding. Mm-hmm. And that's basically where this bodhisattva path is completely endless and open-ended. It's open-ended. I mean, I think this helps us understand also what compassion is. And it helps us understand what emptiness is. Because emptiness and compassion are essentially totally inseparable. And so you can't really have one without the other. You cannot experience or really grok emptiness without fundamentally opening to compassion. Because it's the same thing. How is it the same? Well, we'll start with just open. It's open. It's unbiased. And what it is, in terms, it's not like we're suddenly going to go out and save the world and, you know, redress all grievances and take care of everybody and get on a white horse. It's about really being responsive. It's natural response. It's completely natural. It's nothing that we're imposing on ourselves from the outside. And so this actually comes as a natural expression of wakefulness. So as we develop rest more and more and train in wakefulness, then we have natural response, which is actually effortless.
Which is what?
Effortless. That's a key point. And so this is a very important aspect of Dharma. As far as we want to go with Dharma, is we learn how to fundamentally relax. You know, relaxation is the key point, not struggle. When we find ourselves struggling, for whatever reason we have, we're lost. We've moved away from simplicity and peace and openness. We're turning it into a thing. Right? We're trying to move on. We're trying to impose an idea or reach a point of perfection we think already exists, and we're just trying to struggle to get there. So this is where it's very different. It's not like, you know, we have these high bars of achievement that we're all requiring to go to when we get on the bhumi. We're actually learning how to actually trust ourselves and actually... This is where the Buddha nature actually begins to develop, because it's developing freely, and it's being allowed to come through without struggle.
So what I was thinking of when you mentioned that about emptiness and compassion, these acts of heroic acts, people actually, things people do where they put their own life in jeopardy to save someone else, but it's like a spontaneous response to rescuing someone and without thinking about the fact that they could actually die too.
They don't think about it.
They don't think about it. They just go. And that then, I think that's a good example mm-hmm. of that open heart of compassion where it's not a reflection back, you know, clutching to self, but just the heart opens and there's an extension out, literally a hand reaching out to save someone.
And it's very clear. It's not like right. choked up and crying and freaking out. It's actually simply doing what needs to be done. It's really, really straightforward.
Like a mother protecting child.
Yes.
You just leap forward.
Affection.
Yeah.
So that's a good way. These are methods to which we can begin to understand how compassion is working mm-hmm. and how it somehow, it isn't like everybody's going to be a hero or every moment there's going to be some kind of a crisis that we have to jump into. But it's not necessary. We have our internal crises going on all the time once we start listening.
But it could be very small, listening. Actually.
It could just be walking down the street and suddenly paying attention and seeing something that, you know, suddenly picking up something for somebody. Even a common, everyday, simple courtesy. Just, it's like you're not thinking about me. I can just take care of something needs to be done. I'm dealing with it. And it's just, that's how we do it. So it's really simple. And also, so this is a very important point. And then we talk about, getting down here on the fourth paragraph here. Compassion is a combination of maitri and generosity.
Yes,
a journey outward.
Yeah, that's really
communication. So on the one hand, it's feeling friendly towards yourself, and we must be compassionate towards ourselves. That's the first object of compassion. Please understand that. We need compassion a lot. In case you haven't noticed. I mean, look, you know, I'll speak for myself. I screw up all the time. I'm constantly doing things that I could just get so and I can't, and I do get upset. And it's like, just open up and realize that, you know, this is a person who's just doing what they are trying to do, and this is a human situation. Being human, as we say, I mean, Alexander Pope said, to err is human, to forgive divine. But, you know, we're going to actually bring divinity into our life this way. We start with forgiving ourselves.
Well, where does the spontaneous compassion really come when you need it most?
When you need it the most. That's actually when. When actually...
But when you're saying to yourself, oh, geez, I really screwed that up.
So these are...
I haven't done that in a long time. It's like, I really should... That's very human of you. Don't you feel better? No.
Nobody's saying you're going to feel better. That doesn't mean you're going to feel better.
But it's not spontaneous.
You're there.
It's sort of like giving myself a lecture or something.
You're not beating yourself up. And you're not patronizing yourself. You're just being available to the moment. You're being on the spot, which means really being open to the pain. And it is pain. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm just speaking for myself. I mean, look, so it's there. I'm really willing to be there and burn with that pain of being so stupid and making some mistake. And that's part of what it means to just be true.
So that's like in meditation when you can stop and drop the storyline. So the same thing in everyday kind of.
Yeah.
Stop yourself and take that time to kind of drop your storyline and feel it.
There's some kind of friendliness. I mean, you begin to get to know yourself, and it kind of can turn from I'm such a jerk to oh, there I did that again.
Humor.
Yeah. Exactly. So slowly you get to know yourself. Like, I always do that. Right.
Sometimes it can be. Of course. And I think the thing is, though, it's not like we're trying to, you know, pat anybody on the back. It's just being there and no judgment.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So compassion means being with, in the sense of just being with. If you have a dear friend who's
I mean, it would be stupid if somebody's just sitting there having a difficult time. You go, "Oh, don't worry, everything's going to be fine." You know, I mean, that just drives me up the wall. I want to punch them in the face. Get out of here! You know, like. But just being there, you're available.
I guess what's interesting to me now is putting together the discussion about spontaneity and impulse, and now this how it relates to compassion.
Yeah.
Ah, you know. It's yeah. So what is
impulse?
Pardon?
What is impulse?
Impulse is your ego is taking time. Oh, now what would be the compassionate thing to do? And you're actually taking time to think about. You're reacting. It's your ego reacting and thinking. But spontaneity is something that is like that gap that just sort of just happens.
So the more
and
we
then to read that. Oh, compassion is that. Oh. I hadn't thought about that. I thought compassion was a much more conscious kind of decision almost sometimes.
So when you're really...
But it's not. Compassion is not a decision.
No.
It's not. Choice and...
That's really...
He quotes Krishnamurti here about choiceless awareness. So, you know, what it means is we can't plan on any kind of compassionate event. You know, it's more about just when the more we are willing to simply relax into the present as it is and open ourselves up, this is where this Maitri and openness takes us. It's like it helps us because we're all in this process of journeying to somewhere that never began, as it were, to use a poetic expression, so that our attitude of openness makes us more sensitive to actually situations that we might not otherwise see because we're so busy trying to be compassionate to everybody. what's actually going on. So we're just really here. And I mean, again, this can't be overemphasized. The point of really being present and training in present. And so that's where, when we practice meditation, then we have what's called post-meditation of asking ourselves and even praying or supplicating that we can have some kind of continuity between our meditation and post-meditation. Mm-hmm. We're not just cutting it off. Now I can go back to being automatic, you know.
So I'd like to come back to the sentence that you read because I think it's, my question is generosity, and that's the first paramita.
That's right.
Which is interesting. It's sort of like a little plant here for something in the future we're going to see more of. Compassion is a combination of Maitri and generosity and is a journey outward communication. There's a lot in that one sentence. That seems very important. The generosity aspect, I think that sense of that reaching out and being of benefit, that seems like generosity.
And that's articulated in the next paragraph.
Okay.
saying, we might go through the details of the nature of compassion and how you feel compassionate. Compassion has a sense of communication. So compassion is real communication, even if you say nothing. Your presence is already your availability to the situation is the communication. And then, you know, if there's something to say and it's appropriate, you say it. You know, but it's not because you figured it out. It's because you're really there and it's just a natural response. We're back to this term, natural response. Think of that as very primordial. I mean, just basically, being responsive is basically relating to the situation you find yourself in. And if you're doing it, we're talking about completely being genuine in this process. So, it says that fish can't live without water. Likewise, compassion can't develop without egolessness, without shunyata experience. So without our first recognition of really not being those people who do perform great acts or heroic acts like Emily just mentioned, nobody's checking out how they're feeling at that moment. There's no self-reference point at all. Just completely gone. And doesn't mean that they're going to be that way an hour later. They could be completely self-absorbed at the next moment. But they're just doing it on the spot. And so we're talking about, you know, training. We don't have to require some kind of an emergency situation to
to do this. And so the training is this openness and egolessness. And the egolessness, we start with egolessness of self. And so if we even just stick with that right now, because learning about the next phase, egolessness of other, is a much bigger project. But simply getting ourselves out of the way is the first major step. And we do that through our practice and meditation. Is that clear?
I have a perhaps too wayward of a question. But is there any difference between compassion and empathy? Is empathy kind of this the same kind of thing between impulse and spontaneity? Do you know what I mean?
I think it can be related, but I wouldn't equate it. A lot of people can be empathic without necessarily leaving their comfortable point of self-reference, and you can actually be truly affected by seeing a situation, you know, and feeling for that situation, being sympathetic, for instance, that sympathetic response, mm-hmm. right? But I wouldn't conflate that with compassion. Compassion is like emptiness, transcendent. As Emily says, this is beyond the workings of the mind. Generally, when we're empathic, we think about what we're empathic about. We're thinking about the plight of some situation. Mm-hmm. Right. We're contemplating turning
it's more
over.
Remote.
Yeah, we can actually be getting into a discourse, a discursive kind of project mm-hmm. about that.
Empathy, me and you, or compassion is sort of all of a sudden the space is much bigger.
Yeah.
If that makes any sense.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. The compassion takes in the whole space, the whole environment.
I, for myself, I'll confess, oftentimes when I, like, if I turn on the news, which is an easy way for me to get cranked up, and I sit here and I get very empathetic about the whole thing. Yeah. And then I notice a lot of self-consciousness embedded in that process. So I don't equate or assume that that's compassion at all.
But what do you mean by self-consciousness exactly?
Because I next see how I'm locating myself in the process of feeling sympathetic and or feeling frustrated or feeling concerned.
For and against.
Yeah, and taking a position, you know,
politics.
Like bingo, okay. Right, here I am, this is it, you know, like
right.
kind of thing. Yeah.
Well, my experience of empathy, especially in light of what I'm learning about compassion, is that I'm looking for feedback, right? I want to know, am I feeling what you're feeling? Because if I am, then I am. And I'm doing it right.
And I am.
Yeah. And if I don't, then I think, oh, geez, I'm kind of laying down as a human being, and now I'm, again, it's more self-conscious.
About yourself.
Well, he talks about that further in the text, about sort of this idiot compassion, about
yeah.
becoming this project of the person who's going to fix somebody.
There's a different sort of, I read the thing about, you know, to develop compassion or whatever, to think about, like, the mother with no arms, whose baby is being swept away, and how, like, just feeling it, and as the empathy sort of thinking, like, wow, that would feel really bad if that happened to me.
Yeah,
right.
Like you're in the
yeah, exactly,
right.
exactly. You're putting
like
yourself right in the middle of the
yeah.
whole process. So I really like this sentence in the same paragraph.
Yeah.
Compassion is the heart of the practice of meditation and action.
Yeah, of course.
I would, like to, would anybody like to comment on what they think about that sentence? And that means you could ask, but you know, if you don't understand or you want clear anything, if you would you like to comment on it or question it?
So first, do you remember meditation in action? How would you describe that? What is that? Off the cushion. Yes, post-meditation experience.
Mm-hmm.
Post-meditation where you're just living your life, mm-hmm. but there's a sense of going about things, still holding the memory or the immediacy of the meditative experience.
not dropping it, just stepping into life, bringing it with you.
The glow, you can say.
Well, I said about that.
Letting that glow of meditation. Because actually, he even said something here. I thought it was funny.
Radiation.
Okay, yeah.
He said
the warmth.
Yeah.
Okay. You know, he says here on the next page, second paragraph, when the sitting meditation is completed and the gong rings and you decide to stop, you find you're experiencing better meditation at that point. You know, okay, done. All right. you know, all the struggles have gone, all the chaos has dissolved. You have a sense of relief as if you were entering into nirvana, as if meditation was a samsaric act. At that moment, there's an absence of struggle, a sense of warmth, a sense of freedom. And that lift, you know, so it's kind of a lift, right? You know, I've been sitting here completely just settling, not going anywhere, resting, dropping everything, you know, and just letting my mind just go like that. And then suddenly,
well, actually, I love how he begins the previous paragraph. During sitting, we find ourselves completely chaotic.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. I was so happy to read that.
Somebody finally
I think that's a real key factor, because first we think meditation is simple. Okay, all we have to do is sit and basically work with our breath and 25% of the time and just rest and maintain a good posture. And then we discover, this, I can't do this. I never had any kind of thoughts like this until I started sitting. You know, the typical thing, you know, like, well, guess what? That's what's always going on. You know, this kind of...
For all of us,
torrent,
by the way.
Torrent of gossip, of just weird scribbled, you know, squibbling voices, and, you know, like anything, you name it, playbacks for, you know, TV programs you saw 35 years ago, or, you know, anything you want, it's all, you know, just rushing along in this undercurrent, and we're tapping into this kind of, you know, it's like opening the manhole and listening to the...
We've been here before in this particular.
Oh yeah, that was a talking game. Oh no, let's not revisit that.
It's all
it's coming back.
Okay, so. At this point, he's saying, with this absence of struggle and sense of warmth and freedom, if you can't deliberately create that, it just comes about. It's just there. It's just something that happens. And that crescendo is created by the sitting meditation, which brings this release. And then this feeling is a feeling that you could say compassion and the shunyata experience are happening simultaneously. So that means you're available, you're not, there's no, you know, you're just there. And being there means you're there.
And this word, shunyata, means emptiness.
So it's real communication. So here he introduces this, at this point, this notion of glimpse as an actual technique. We've already started this when we actually do the meditation practice, and we simply see our thoughts and we drop them. Even when we have insights, we never hang on to them. It doesn't matter. We just absolutely let them go. And so we start that on the cushion. And then as we go forward and we're actually off the cushion and we're functioning, walking, talking, we can pay attention to hear our words more clearly and the impact they may be having on the person to whom we're speaking. But it's a glimpse. It's not like suddenly I'm taking out my megaphone here. Like, what did I just say? Like, you're just basically there, and you drop it. It's glimpsing. And we even talked about this when we introduced the notion a long time ago of how do we actually just connect with what we call absolute bodhicitta, is you just flash. You know, it's just a quick thing. It's not like I'm going to try to just completely soak myself in the absolute. You flash on it, and you drop it. That flash is very important because that's how we actually familiarize ourselves with this whole process, in little flashes.
So the word flash here is important to just say. It's not like a flash bulb or necessarily light. That's not what is being meant by flash. I think it's more just means something quick.
Yeah, and
touching.
That's the game.
Sorry, Michael?
Touching.
Mm-hmm. Touch and go. It's a glimpse, and we're willing to be content with the glimpse.
Because trying to retain it is the opposite of what we're going for.
Then we lose it even faster that way. You know, and that becomes frustrating. We're not being relaxed anymore. We're tightening up because I want that, you know.
So this is like briefly turning our full attention wherever, or to everything, I guess, and then just letting it go.
That's right.
Yeah,
that's right. And in fact, the more I've studied Trungpa Rinpoche's teachings, one of the things he talked about when you could meditate, if you ever wanted to try this, was just allowing yourself, particularly when you feel extremely, like if you're sitting for 3 or 4 hours and you're feeling periods of utter desolation, dullness, just intensify just being there. You know, hold, and then let go. You hold for just a moment, but really hold it, and then you release. And it really helps to actually come back to just being present. So you're not, again, because we can get so caught up in the notion we're in some kind of project, and it seems endless.
I think this part, I think it's the paragraph where you are, the scriptures talk about the bodhisattvas. Mm-hmm. So it's further down, it says, it's this glimpse, it's so fast and so sharp.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the description. One sixtieth of a second.
60th.
If you can imagine that. The sharpness part is intelligent compassion. And compassion in this case being open.
That's
actually, this is an important point.
That's actually learning more about the nature of awareness itself. It's very sharp. Sharp is up meaning abrupt or angular in the sense of being brutal or hurtful. It's just quick. It's just instant. It doesn't have any kind of analysis connected with it. There's no kind of track.
It's like penetrating insight.
Yeah, exactly. Just in that, like he uses this term of taking a needle and going through a flower.
That was amazing. I hear it, but I never understood it.
Yeah.
Now I feel like 30 years with all these. I keep going back to the same stuff over and over again. Yeah, interesting. So that's fascinating, that section on the petal.
And so there's two things that are happening. One is happening that's going to go on the whole time. We're back to square one in terms of a process of continually unmasking. But the unmasking is also done in the sense of a glimpse. It's not like suddenly I'm trying to tear this mask off and go through that. It's just like, see it and then let it go. You see it and drop it. You don't pick it up and go, look what I just found. And that's a way, that's actually cultivating gentleness, which is another aspect of this whole thing. Gentleness is a key point of this sharpness. It's because it's so sharp and so profound. It's also very sensitive and very capable of accommodating its space is so gentle. Now, these are things that you can contemplate because I think that it's something that you, it helps when you are simply giving it some room to turn over a little bit, at some later time. You want to spend a little time with teaching because we're going to go a long way with this stuff. And we're just basically, I don't want to say we're scratching the surface because we're getting into some really important stuff, but, you know, we are, it's really something we're going to continue with.
It's more of an introduction.
Yeah. But the notion of this glimpse, of this flash, is going to continue. It's not like we're going to suddenly get this long, drawn-out, 20-minute kind of glimpse. It's going to be instantaneous. And that's actually what's happening. We're just living in a series of instants.
Well, I got to say one thing. You talk about flashes, and you talk about, well, it isn't really a photograph, but when you say 60th of a second, flashes in my mind, like when you're sinking a camera with a flash, it's usually a 60th of a second. Mm-hmm. So, you know, just, you know, the flash is the time. And I always just always think of, you know, the times I've taken photographs, I'm just, you know, like I'm capturing that instance of time right then and there, and then it's gone. Mm-hmm. It's just like, you know, just boom, boom, mm-hmm. boom, 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 boom. Mm-hmm. So it's just, It's a really great way of understanding that whole concept.
I was just thinking, if I may say, this gentleness is really interesting, this petal being penetrated. It has to be very gentle in order to actually do that precisely without tearing.
Yeah, you're not mangling it.
Right. There's no aggression involved in this.
Exactly. Really sharp. So again, about these glimpses, we are doing this several times a day as a way of checking in. And this is how we also can do our post meditation experiences. Let's say we've done 20 minutes on the cushion or something, or we're going to later on in the day. How can I deal with my day? You know, how can I deal with just going through my day? I've got stuff to do. I've got to work. I've got to talk to people, etc. So, you know, you can just, like, look out the window for a second. Mm-hmm. You can do these little things that are just quick reminders of just being there. And if there's no commentary on it at all. And it seems so fast that you almost think it has no relevance or significance. But I have found personally that over time, this actually starts to change the quality of your experience, so that you stay, you're more with things, you're fresher, and you're not just sort of, you know, in this kind of like a train of moving along because you were there 5 minutes ago. And so he goes on about this on the top of the next page. And he says that glimpse of compassion and shunyata, and we have to start trusting what we're experiencing here, compassion and shunyata, as being inseparable. This is actually the content of that glimpse, that open flash, that simple glimpse. This is what we're discovering, that emptiness and compassion are together in that glimpse. Just really just like that. It starts to cut the chain of karmic causal characteristics. At the same time, you are communicating fully and completely when the penetration is going on, when you are cutting the chain. So it's that cutting. It just cuts it on the spot. And you are catching a quick glimpse of the Buddha nature at the same time. So let's read that carefully. If a process is divided into three sections, first there's Maitri, trusting in the heart. Secondly, there's a gap in which you experience this openness of Tathagatagarbha, Buddha nature. And thirdly, a sense of communication, having already woken up to that level, a sense of freedom to expand, to relate to whatever you are doing. Okay, so I realize we have a lot more we can discuss here. I mean, I could go on for a long time about the contents in here. I'm really finding it quite rich. But why don't we have a little time for discussion and questions?
I'd love to hear a little more about this idea of communication, because it kind of stopped me. Maybe I'm beginning to get it, but it's something short, because it sounds like something to do or something, an action. But what I'm understanding here is that he's actually talking about openness and communication as effectively the same thing. Mm-hmm. And that what we're doing there is just kind of being open. The communication is more energetic. Am I understanding that?
Yeah, it is energetic. We are talking about energetics, and this energetic is space.
Yeah.
Space is not dead, blank, vacuum. It's living.
Right.
And this is living space. So it is the nature of communication. This is where the communication really happens, where there's space.
So in some sense, cultivating, I don't know what the right way to say this is, but if we're cultivating this openness or we're ultimately just kind of resting in it, we don't have to do anything with it. We just bring it with us. It's the thing that compassion, I don't know, rides on.
It's already there, actually.
Yeah. Okay. We're not bringing anything. We're actually discovering it on the spot.
Yeah.
So your idea of sort of practicing is just then the moment when you need it, it'll pop up because you're not like trying to figure out how to do it. So when you're in the situation where compassion would be a good thing, you don't have to say, I wonder what I should do. You're like, you have that experience of openness enough that it comes up on its own.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Initially, it's going to take some, you know, effort. It isn't that big effort, but it's just, you know, reminding myself to practice, reminding myself to just like that, just like that. And you know, as you do it more, it becomes more natural and more available. You become more available to the moment. You just start doing it because you realize that that's a source of freshness and real presence.
Really nice, optimistic kind of way of thinking about people, which is just that, as we were just saying, the compassion's there. When you're not blocking it in all sorts of ways, it's just there.
Mm-hmm.
And you're not, like you're describing, yeah, you're not interpreting anything. It's just that there's someone else there, and you just respond. And that's exactly what you just said.
Mm-hmm.
But it's there. It's really nice, because there are all these philosophers, you know, people naturally evil, and we have to make ourselves good, and we're naturally good. I mean, it sounds like it's good. It's like it's there. So
we're talking basic goodness here.
Yeah.
That's how it works.
Exactly.
You know, this is just a line I really appreciated. Because instead of facing the situations and feeling like, well, I haven't got what's needed here, he talks about experiencing a sense of richness, that you can expand the warmth you feel towards yourself, that you feel towards yourself to the rest of sentient beings. I really appreciated the sense that it could be true, or I could experience that it's true, that I'm not coming at this with something I don't have, but with everything I need.
Mm-hmm. So, is anyone here who thinks they can't do this? Why not? Somebody has to say it, right?
Well, you know what I want to know, though, is this reminds me of the paramitas, which, so I'm going to get you out of the hot seat for a second.
That was a very compassionate act.
So this brings to mind the paramitas, because I feel like those are things that there's something we can do. Those are,
right.
There's a conscious action, right? I can strive to be patient, I can strive to be generous, and so on. Mm-hmm. This feels a little bit less like there isn't a thing, a practice to practice. So what is there?
If you really practice 24/7, that's what it is. This is practice 24/7.
This is like the hardest thing there is. I mean, yes, when you're sitting with people you love and everything is hunky-dory, but the workplace comes to mind, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Like, to really, like, be with this in a really moment-by-moment basis, I feel like that could take a lifetime.
And what he's saying right here is actually all of the paramitas at once are all contained in what mm-hmm. we're discussing here.
Mm-hmm.
So the paramitas are more qualities that develop as engagement in terms of practicing on the path. We're learning how to develop those qualities, and we'll be exploring different aspects, and they're all interactive. I mean, the most important single point right now is ensuring we have good meditation practice. Because without the meditation, we're not going to be able to understand how to fundamentally open up and be generous and have a kindness to ourselves, mercy to ourselves, and kindness to others, and learn how to actually forgive and go forward and have these moments of flashing. I mean, they can happen, but, you know, this is where it's going to be within, make it much easier and more familiarize ourselves with these qualities.
So after all this talk, we're now off the hook of paradox. Effort, no effort.
Right.
No effort, effort. We have to figure that out. It's not, we can't talk ourselves out of paradox.
Actually, that brings to mind in our glimpses of Abhidharma, he basically said, being is hard work. Being is hard work.
Yeah. Because it's totally easy and effortless, right?
Yeah, effortlessness is hard.
Paradox, right?
So, Roberta, since you are already a great bodhisattva, tell us about that.
Oh, Jesus.
Please.
Oh, Neil. Okay.
Tell us.
Suggested, I say every day that I am Buddha, and that is like being the sun, and ego is clouds that just block the sun. Is this what you're talking about?
Just tell us about it. The great bodhisattva.
I have no idea what you are suggesting.
That's good.
Well, you said something very beautiful.
Yeah.
That was beautiful, what you just presented. I was told to say that.
Do you believe it? Yes. Sometimes. Sometimes.
Oh, good.
Yes,
good.
I certainly good. Can see.
You're working with it.
I mean, I work with it. People who have done really terrible things mm-hmm. and spent a lot of time in prison mm-hmm. and killed people. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, I can see Buddha in them.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Yeah, that's really important.
I mean, you really can. You see people. I mean, the ones that have lived, that, you know, a lot more than the dead. I end up with the older guys, and there's not that many. Because they are the ones, you know, who have medical problems. Mm. But there's very few of them. There's not mostly die young. So, but they reach a point where the violence is not okay anymore for them. And their gentleness comes out. Mm. And their sweetness will be more very evident.
That's great.
I think it's a drop in testosterone, actually. Chemistry change is part of it.
That was good.
I mean, you know, young men, I mean, they're just so loaded.
Yeah.
War and, you know, procreation.
Oh, yes. Right.
They're like,
that's right. So for a young person who have to cope with these teachings mm-hmm. would help people learn how to handle some of these energetics mm-hmm. that are coming through them, you know, which just want to go assert themselves everywhere they can, and learning how to actually make friends with that and learn how to sit with it so that it actually tames their mind, taming the mind. So that's why taming the mind is so important mm-hmm. before we do anything else. What we're moving on to now is training the mind. Mm-hmm. We're going to tame our mind and train our mind at the same time. We've learned some basics about taming, and now the training will be how we actually develop emptiness, compassion as a fundamental way of understanding who we are and how we can actually engage genuinely with the world. So I'm sure we've had enough for one night. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Quite lovely.
Dedicate the merit.